طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we feature a conversation with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Levy met with a visiting delegation from the United States in Israel, sponsored by the Tree of Life Foundation. Gideon Levy pulls no punches when he speaks and writes. We were fortunate to receive this conversation from a member of the delegation who recorded it exclusively for This Week in Palestine. Here is Israeli journalist Gideon Levy.
My name is Gideon Levy. I'm a columnist for Haaretz, and I'm very, very happy to be here. And I'm following the Tree of Life from distance, and I think you are doing a great job. And I think for people like me, you are the hope. And I'll try to explain why. Because one should understand that the occupation will not come to its end as long as the present situation will continue. For Israel to put an end to the occupation doesn't pay. There's no reason for Israel to put an end to the occupation. No incentive, no motivation, nothing. The status quo is by far better for Israel, in Israeli eyes, than any change in the status quo. The world is just supporting the status quo, except of some lip services. The world is supporting the occupation actively or passively. And the fact is that no one in the world is doing anything serious about putting an end to the occupation. The Palestinians are as weak and as divided as never before. Lacking leadership, lacking energy, lacking being united. And I think, in my view, they are in their worst situation ever since the 60s. And when this is the situation, one shouldn't expect any change, because there is no reason for change. And the idea is to change this situation, in which for Israel the occupation is a better alternative than putting an end to the occupation. That's the only way to bring an end to it. By changing this equilibrium, by making Israel lose, pay, being punished for the occupation, only by this there will be a motivation to put an end to it. Otherwise, it will not happen. This change cannot and will not come from within Israel. I said it 2 years ago when we were together, and I can say it much more now. Because anything which was true 2 years ago is now worse. We are going only to the opposite direction. But without getting into too many, to a resolution of Israeli politics, by the end of the day, for an average Israeli, there is no reason to put an end to the occupation. He is not interested in the occupation. He knows very little about the occupation. He had never been there. His life is wonderful. Why to bother? I mean, he doesn't want to hear about it. And the change cannot come in this situation from within the Israeli society. Cannot come, will not come. Because the Israeli society, as I said, have nothing to lose by continuing the occupation, and have a lot to lose if we put an end to the occupation. Let's be frank. We don't know what will be. Any change can lead to, you know, various directions. And for an Israeli whose life is quite good, why would he go for a change? Why? Especially when brainwash system in this country is so efficient, when so many Israelis are so confident that the IDF is the most moral army in the world, that we are the only victims in the area, that the Palestinians want only one thing, and this is how to exterminate the Jews. Every Palestinian wakes up in the morning with only one thought in his mind: how will he kill as many Jews as possible today? When all those are the main values, and add to this the fact that most of the Israelis, and I was talking about it also when I was there in Connecticut, that most of the Israelis also deeply believe that we are the chosen people, that we have special rights, that we deserve more, that we are the biggest victim in history, and because we are the biggest victims in history, we deserve anything almost, and nobody can tell us what to do. And international law doesn't apply for us, because international law applies for any country, but not for us, because we are a special case. So if you add all this together, we are getting to the quite depressing conclusion that we can't expect a change in the coming future, for sure not from within the Israeli society. And here comes the role of the international community. Because the Israeli society is so much in denial, because the Israeli society has so little interest and motivation, it is on the shoulders of the international community. Now, when it comes to governments, again, why would they bother? And again, we have to admit that if there will be not pressure from within civil societies on the governments, governments will not go very far. I think that the EU, the United States, and many other countries have so many other issues right now. The Palestinians are really one of their last priorities. Who cares? Not only this, we have the Islamophobia, we have the xenophobia, we have the terror, we have Syria, and for most of the Westerns, you know, all the Arabs are the same, all the Muslims are the same. No way that the Palestinians will be perceived as something else. They are one of those Arabs who are a danger, and it's also not in the interest of the EU, for example, to do something extraordinary to put an end to the occupation. Why would they? They really face bigger problems. Not to speak about the United States, not to speak about the United States with Donald Trump, because when I was over there, we still had a president whose heart was at least in the right place. He did nothing, but at least we knew that his heart was in the right place. Nobody expects Donald Trump to stand for justice, for minorities, for Arabs, for Muslims, for any kind of values. I mean, I don't have to say it here. Zero expectations, obviously. And this leaves us really with this situation, which the only name, the only game in town is the civil societies, are the civil societies. That's right now the only player who can really make a change. And when I say civil societies, I mean Tree of Life, I mean you, I mean similar groups, both in Europe and in the United States. In Europe it's much easier in certain countries, because there is more awareness and more knowledge than in the United States. I mean, you know it better than me, but most of the Americans are unfortunately quite ignorant about what's going on here, and whatever they know is so false that many times I say I'd rather have them without any knowledge rather than the knowledge that they have.
Yeah,
I mean, it's better not to know where is Israel and what is Israel and who are the Palestinians rather than to know what they know. Because how many of them are reading New York Times or Haaretz? Very, very few, as we know. So in the United States and in Europe, the situation is a little better in terms of knowledge. I mean, bigger parts of society, not everyone, obviously, but bigger parts of society are more involved, are more concerned, are more knowledgeable. But by the end of the day, the key is, first of all, in the United States. And here I say what I've said again. I'm sorry to repeat myself, Mary, but the day that the United States will wish that the occupation will come to its end, it will end within months. Within months. The United States, let's be frank, never wanted to put an end to the occupation. There was not a single American president, including Barack Obama, who really wanted to put an end to the occupation. How do I know it? Because they did nothing, and they could have done so much more. Peace plans, I mean, the first peace plan was in 1970 by Rogers, the Secretary of State Rogers, before most of you were born. And ever since then, the peace plans repeat themselves. It's always the same ideas. It gets to the same again and again. Tens and tens of peace plans, which say always the same. And then they get into the jury and are totally forgotten. And nobody really means to do something about it. Many, many administrations and governments in Europe, I must say, always believe that with Israel the only way is to go with carrots and to offer Israel the moon, but it didn't work. It never worked. And it will never work. Europe didn't understand it yet, and the United States didn't understand it yet, or maybe they both don't want to understand it. But it will not go with carrots. No way. Now, American administrations paid the lip service, did nothing, but they did more than this. They not only did nothing. They are the financiers of the occupation. They supply the weapons for the occupation. They supply the political support in the international organizations for the occupation. Let's remember it. It's not just that the American administration, all the American administration were passive. No, they were very active pro-occupation. Veto after veto in the Security Council, arms deals, I don't have to tell you, and economical support, like no other country in the world, no other country in the world. You know, big Russia conquered some part of Crimea, of how you call it in English? We call it Crimea. The place where Russia innovated.
Crimea,
yeah. We call it Crimea. And within weeks, the EU put sanctions on Russia. On Russia. The big Russia. Within weeks. And here we face an occupation of 50 years. When sanctions are, it's even not legitimate to mention the word, obviously. But not only sanctions, no pressure, only support. And this brings you to the conclusion that Europe and the United States actively want the continuance of the occupation, because otherwise they wouldn't react like this. And even by their lip service, condemning the settlements, they play a positive role for the occupation. Because this lip service, which Israel totally ignores, enable Israel to go wild, because they know they will play their role, we will play our role. The State Department will condemn Israel, and Israel learned by now that it can totally ignore those condemnation. They have no meaning whatsoever. Now they are even not condemnations. Yeah, with your adorable ambassador to the UN, which, you know, it would be embarrassing for me if she would have been ambassador of Israel. I mean, she's much more pro-Israel than the right-wingers in Israel. I never saw such a thing. Really, that's a phenomena. She is a phenomena, I must tell you. Lies that she's spreading, this woman, and the way she supports Israel, it's really by far more than the right wingers would dream about in Israel. Yeah, this woman, I wrote about her once already. This woman is really embarrassing, but she's the voice of America. Let's face it. She walks with the heels in order to kick all the critics of Israel. Ambassador of the United States. Embarrassing. But in any case, again and again, when we look at the relations between the United States and Israel, as I said in Connecticut, one should ask, who is the superpower between the two? And who is dictating whom in this game? Because really, if you look at it in an objective way, you really can get the impression that Israel is the superpower and the United States is following Israel. And now we face the new phase, which is the big struggle against BDS, which is a new actor, which Israel found after Iran, that's the biggest enemy of Israel. And look how the West is reacting to BDS. This is really an unbelievable phase. They are all over Europe and the United States, this criminalization of BDS. I mean, it's unbelievable in democracies that a civil rights organization, non-violent, democratic, is fighting for a cause. You can agree with this cause, you can disagree, and they criminalize it as if boycott is something criminal. Israel is calling the whole world to boycott Hamas, to boycott Iran. The Israelis are boycotting Turkey because Turkey was not very friendly, so we don't go to Turkey anymore. We went less to vacation in Turkey, and those boycotts are legitimate. People don't want to buy meat, and they boycott shops which sell meat. People want to boycott the labor in East Asia, yeah, the sweat, how you call it? Sweatshops. This is legitimate. People don't want to buy stolen goods. And I boycott. I know that this is stolen good. I don't buy it. But boycotting products from Israel or from the occupied territories, this is criminal. Not less than criminal. In many states already in your country, there are already legislations. You know, that's for you to ask, how is it possible, for God's sake, in a democracy, how can it be that a non-violent step, okay, you can be against it, no problem, but to make it illegal, to call for boycotting and criminal occupation that not one single country in the world supports. Not one single country in the world supports 1 meter of the occupation. So to call to boycott an occupation which, again I say, the entire international community declares as illegal. The entire international community. Not 1 meter, including not Jerusalem. No country in the world. There is no consensus like the international consensus, like the consensus about the occupation. Russia and Europe and Asia and Africa and the United States and the Arab world, and everyone is not recognizing the occupation, perceiving it as illegal. And then to boycott this illegal occupation becomes criminal? and it goes like a fire from state to state, including Europe, including liberal Europe. I was in Germany a few weeks ago in a tour, and they almost in few cities put a condition for my talk when it was in a public venue that I will not support BDS in my speech. Yeah. And I didn't agree. But, and obviously in this country it becomes also illegal. But in Israel it's a different case. Not that I support it, but when the West is criminalizing BDS, I can't complain about Israel, which makes it criminal. And we will struggle here, and even if it will become illegal, I will continue to support it, because BDS is right now the only game in town. That's the only way. If you remember my first part of my talk, when I say that we have to change this balance in which Israel does not pay for the occupation, BDS is the mean to make Israel pay for the occupation, to really shake this situation, which Israel has no incentive to put an end to the occupation. I'm not a BDS activist. I'm not an activist at all. And for me, it took many years until I supported BDS, because it's not very simple to be an Israeli who does not boycott Israel, because I live here. I live here. I buy Israeli products. I pay Israeli tax. It's very complicated to come and say, you boycott what I don't. If you boycott Israel, go away. Why do you live here? So it's not very simple for me to call others to boycott. And I really don't call others, but I must admit, or I must say, that right now that's the only game. Because that's the only way, non-violent way, to make Israel gradually start to pay for the occupation. To make Israelis being punished. And being punished means that then they will start to think about it. Because until they will be punished, until they will pay, nobody will care about the occupation. No way. So this is also a phase which is not very promising, because what the Western governments are doing against BDS. And again, the ball is in your court, in your yard, because you and others are the only one who can make now a change. That's the truth. Change will come only from civil societies, who will push governments, hopefully, your own governments, and that's the only way to go for a change. Last word, because I want to leave time for questions. Last word about the two state, one state, and again I repeat myself for those who heard me already, but it must be said. I was a great supporter of the two state solution. The two state solution is the most logical solution. Two peoples share one state, let's divide it. That's the simple way and the most logical way. I think that the two state solution is not viable anymore. I think we missed the chance. I think Israel and the settlers have done everything possible to make this solution impossible, and they succeeded. And we have to face it. You know, to continue to speak about two-state solution when deep in our hearts we know it will never happen, it's again falling into a trap that Israel is putting. Israel wants everyone to speak about two-state. Even Netanyahu spoke about two states. Why not? Let's speak about two states. With no intention whatsoever to enable it ever. And how do we know that Israel never meant it? Because Israel never stopped building the settlements. And anybody who builds one house in the occupied territories have no intention to evacuate the West Bank ever. Because you don't build in a place where you have any intention to evacuate. And you know, Israel never stopped under any government. So as long as Israel does not stop building settlements, we know that Israel does not want the two-state solution. Very simple, as simple as this. That's the only indication. If you build in the West Bank, you mean to stay in the West Bank. Very simple. And if this is the case, and we got already so many settlers, which I don't believe any Israeli will be ever able to evacuate, we have to, it's very hard to admit, but we have to admit that they won and we lost. And we have to start to think what is the alternative. And not to be stuck, you know, in yesterday's solution, because it will never happen. It's a train that left already the station and will never be back. And again, if someone will convince me that the two-state solution is still viable, I'll be more than happy. But I don't see it happening. And therefore, the discourse must change. It's a long way to go. But we have to start to talk about equal rights. We have to start to talk about one man or one person, one vote. We have to start to talk about the one-state solution. Now, for Israelis, this is last Friday. This time, I had another lecture with well-off Israelis. They meet, they have a parliament in a very luxurious restaurant every Friday. You know, the mainstream of the mainstream. I was the youngest, by the way, which is very rare. And I spoke with them about the one-state solution, and I saw that they can't swallow their food. I mean, they regretted so much inviting me. This was far beyond what they could not only digest, but hear. Yeah, because this means that Zionism must come to its end. And this will be very, 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 very hard for almost every Israeli. The idea of a Jewish state will have to come to its end. No Israeli, I mean, I can hardly think about 10 Israelis who would support it right now. I mean 10, not 10,000 and not 10 million. 10 Israelis. I don't think there are more than 10 Israelis living in Israel who are supporting right now, which doesn't seem very promising and doesn't seem as a clear majority. It's a very, very long way to go. We have to start it because we have no other choice. We have to start to talk about it. I start to talk about it, but I know it's a very long way, but that's the only open way. We have just to tell everybody, including in your country, that a one-state solution is not such a revolution. We are living for 50 years now in a one-state. It's not such a revolution. The only problem is that this state is not a democracy. That's the only problem. It is a democracy for Jewish citizens, but it's not a democracy in the occupied territory. So the only thing is to make it a democracy. The one state is here, and the binational state is here, because we are already between the river and the sea. We are 50% Palestinians and 50% Jews, and nobody can change it. And Gaza is part of it. They always say, no, no, but without Gaza. What do you mean without Gaza? What will Gaza, where will Gaza go again? To the ocean? Without Gaza, because Gaza is another 2.5 million people, yeah? No, Gaza is part of the Palestinian people. So by the end of the day, for the very long run, I think this should be the discourse. It is hard to sell it right now, to market it in your country. It is impossible to market in this country. When I start to speak about it, people really think that I should go to a therapist. That's the usual reaction. But when you come and tell them, what do you suggest? No, no, a Jewish state, two-state solution. I say, yeah, but where have you been? If you wanted the Jewish state, where have you been in the last 50 years? You did anything possible to destroy it. So how can you speak now about the Jewish state? You can't eat the cake and have it. It's either or. You want a Jewish state, you can't have the occupied territories. You want the occupied territories, you can't have a Jewish state. It is so simple. And by the end of the day, obviously, it is also the most just solution. Because if we go for equal rights, then we don't have the problem of the 2 million Palestinians who live in Israel, who are citizens of Israel, 2 million, 20% of the citizens of Israel, who is a question by itself. We can solve the problem of return, the right of return, because if it's an equal democracy, then there are equal rights, and then immigration to the state will be on an equal basis, Jews and Palestinians. There must be a policy. No country opens its gates, you know, in an unlimited way. There will be a policy in which Palestinians and Jews will be able to immigrate to this country. But for this, you need first to change the regime. So it's a very, very long way to go. And I have no illusions. And right now, everything looks really, really hopeless. But as I always say, many, many things in history happened without anybody expecting it. I always mention the collapse of Soviet Russia. Nobody had foreseen it. The collapse of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Nobody had foreseen it. The fall of the Berlin Wall. Nobody had foreseen it. And even not the Arab Spring. Nobody, no expert saw it coming. And nobody knows now where are we going to. Because as Shimon Peres always say, all the experts are experts for what had happened already. No expert is for what's going to happen. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take your questions, remarks, whatever. I'm at your service.
Now I'm really depressed.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, but at least it was...
The morning wasn't bad.
I hope the others gave you more hope. I'm sure that Jeff... No. You met Jeff Harper,
yeah,
you said? I'm sure Jeff Harper is more optimistic than me. He is by character much more optimistic, so I'm sure he was more hopeful than me, but... I'll be happy to be convinced that I'm wrong. I'll be very, very happy to hear that I'm totally wrong and the solution is around the corner.
Jeff said that 85% of the land that the Palestinians were chased off of is still open. Is that true, in your opinion?
Jeff is much better than me in figures. Mm-hmm. And if Jeff said so, absolutely. Yeah.
The problem, I was surprised to hear that.
Yeah. The problem is with the figure of settlers. Because together with Jerusalem, we are almost 700,000 settlers. And that's a figure, it's 450 without Jerusalem, but how can we exclude Jerusalem? There are settlers as well. I mean, Israel annexed Jerusalem, but it doesn't make it less occupied. So I don't see a solution without evacuating them. And I don't see anyone evacuating 700 settlers, which are the strongest political group in Israeli society, don't forget. Those settlers are the most powerful group in our politics, by far. They are devoted, they are well organized. Unlikely the mainstream, who is totally apathetic and indifferent, they are very active, and therefore they are very powerful. In any government.
Kadeen, as you know, I frequently open the day by looking online to read Haaretz.
Hmm.
And your columns give me hope, although I don't know why they give me hope.
I failed. If it gives you hope, I failed.
But the role of journalism, I think, is a critical one here and at home. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these people come from different workplaces.
Right.
What are the dynamics among journalists on this issue? And could you share a little bit about what life is like within the Haaretz office?
Absolutely. About Israeli journalism, they are all labeled as leftists and as the leftist mafia. The truth is that maybe there is a majority of leftist journalists in this country, but Israeli media and Israeli newspapers and Israeli TV are totally supporting the Zionistic narrative, and really with the only exception of Haaretz, they are all recruited, self-recruited, by the way, with self-censorship, very little pressure from the government. But because of commercial reasons, because everyone wants to sell newspapers or to get rating, they all betray their mission. They all don't tell the truth about the occupation. Israeli average media consumer doesn't get any picture about the occupation and knows very little about it. And whatever he knows is always very biased dehumanization, really, and demonization. Every teenager of 14 who goes with a knife to the checkpoint is immediately labeled as a terrorist. And every execution of such a terrorist is obviously the only way to deal with a 14-year-old girl who had a fight with her mother 2 hours before and went to the checkpoint in order to commit suicide, and the soldiers helped her to commit suicide. She will be perceived as an existential threat to Israel, and the execution will be presented as the only way to fight terror, and this happens on a weekly basis. Yeah. Many, many periods, even on a daily basis. The Israeli media is the biggest collaborator with the occupation. And they do so against maybe their own conscience. And they don't do it out of ideology. They do it because this is the only way to sell. Because you don't want to bother your readers. And if you do so, people will leave you. The other day, just to give you the idea of the atmosphere in this country, a teacher in a high school in a very well-off town in the south community, it's even not a town, it's a small community, quite well-off, quite developed people, really from upper middle class. She wrote in her Facebook page that she supports the asylum seekers and their right to live here, which is another issue. And now there is immediately after she wrote really some posts about the right of the African asylum seekers to stay with us, there is immediately a movement of the parents in her school, and she had to leave the school within days because they labeled her as a traitor, as a right winger, as a left winger, which is a curse in Israel. To be a leftist in Israel is a curse. And she had to leave. She had to leave her school. It's just from this week. This happens on a weekly basis, daily basis. It is really McCarthyism, but McCarthyism was in many ways less aggressive than what's happening here. Because it goes down to the society. It's not that it comes from the government only, it comes also from the street, from the society itself. In this case of the teacher, even the ministry, the education ministry, supported her, which was quite surprising, because the minister of education is a real extreme right winger. But he supported her, but the street said it word, and nobody could stop it, and she had to resign. So that's the atmosphere right now in Israel. And that's the atmosphere also in the media, except of my newspaper, in which, as I told you 2 years ago, I can tell you this also today, that I gained full support, full freedom. And so I'm not only the only one in this newspaper. Not everyone shares my views. But the freedom is total, and until now, no pressure whatsoever, no pressure whatsoever. And I can tell you that I go more and more radical. Nobody stops me, nobody. Really, total freedom. And even not the government or the secret services, nothing. I have no problems, until now. I don't take it for granted. Yes, please.
We heard from a young woman who was active with Breaking the Silence, and it seems to me that that certainly should have an effect, or at least to get people, some Jews in Israel and around the world, starting to think about what the occupation means. I mean, that's really brave of these young people to come out and give testimony. Is that having any impact?
When Breaking the Silence was established, we thought that this will be a game changer. Because this is not Gideon Levy, the traitor, the communist, the self-hating Jew, but soldiers who were there, who give testimonies about what they have done in person. But immediately, the establishment, it's a very interesting case. The establishment, on one hand, the army and the media, together started a very brutal campaign of delegitimizing Breaking the Silence, and they crushed them. And Breaking the Silence today is perceived like BDS, I mean, as an enemy of this country, a really enemy. And they succeeded. No impact whatsoever, because they delegitimized them in a way that it was all gone. And this was a very good example of collaboration between the military establishment and the media, who did it again voluntarily. They didn't do, nobody forced the media to take part in it. And I can tell you that some of the programs who did all kind of terrible investigation about Breaking the Silence, they're all leftists, liberals, but they know what is expected from them. So unfortunately, they had no impact whatsoever, and they are now labeled as the worst enemies. And then you have no influence. Once you are labeled as an enemy, so who will listen to you? As liars. They're all labeled as liars also. Yes, please.
Yeah, Gideon, this week it was reported that Jewish Voice for Peace has started a campaign to encourage young Jewish kids, college students, to sign a petition stating that they would not take a birthright trip to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about your reaction to that strategy, both in terms of JVP as an organization, the value of that to the JVP as an organization, and also as to how that would affect those kids.
It's by far the right thing to do. I have a relative, a very distant relative, who tried to establish an organization which took kids who came with Taglit, birthright, to stay, extend their stay here for a few more days, and they took them to see the occupation, which was fantastic, but so very few did it. And I think he died, I don't know. He is now in Indonesia for many years, so I don't know if I lost contact. I don't think they didn't succeed much, because finally most of the Jewish kids were very happy with what they get, and very few of them stayed. They got it, by the way, for free. You stay another week and we take care of you, and they took them really to see a refugee camp, everything that they didn't see. This was fantastic. If this would be the case, I would say, let's make it happen. Let them go to the Zionistic propaganda. But if they are exposed also to the other side of the moon, that's fair. But this will not happen. I don't know how effective it will be, this step. But birthright is so destructive. They are brainwashing them. Really, it's embarrassing. They take them. When I see them always, they take them. They always have those guards with old guns which can't shoot, but just to show them in which terrible danger the Jews are living in this country. They are so scared to get out of their homes, because any corner there might be an Arab who will come and slaughter us. So we have those armed guys who guard us, who save us from the terrible danger. Really annoying.
Did you say that the extend was created? That's a good thing, extend?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was a cover-up, and maybe they were going into the West Bank and seeing ridiculous things.
No,
so
there was.
Extend was good.
It was excellent. They took them really to extend was the name. Yeah. They took them to see refugee camps. I followed them once. They went to Ramallah. They went to refugee camps. They showed them the occupation in very few days, because they had only few days.
Yeah.
But at least they opened their eyes. But so very few participated. That's the problem. But it was very good. Very, very good. Again, if Jewish Voice for Peace will succeed, this will be fantastic. But as we know, we are a minority. Jewish Voice for Peace is a minority, but I think that birthright is very destructive, very, very destructive. And it's also, you know, in terms even of, okay, propaganda, but, you know, if you take teenagers and you sell them so many lies and you hide so many truths, so much truth, and you don't take them to see everything. I don't say take them only to Ramallah or take them only to a refugee camp. Okay. But when you don't show them anything from this side and you tell them all those rubbish about the dangers and the victimization, that's, and those are young people, you know, they will carry it forever.
How about our congressional representatives, members of Senate? Have any of them sought out your perspective on things?
Not that I know. Mm-hmm. Not that I know, no.
That's the impasse that we have at home. Yeah. We live in Connecticut, which with two of the most progressive senators and some excellent representatives on every other issue, but not this one.
That's a question mark. How come? I mean, even human rights activists, when they come to this issue as if this is a different game, I never understood it. How can it be? I mean, really, you talk to intelligent liberals, and when it comes to Israel, all of a sudden. But look, you see also a lot of progress. I understand that in the campuses, things are happening. You know it better than I.
Israel
is very nervous. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Israel is very nervous about BDS means that BDS must be doing something right. Roger Waters, our friend, is now having a tour. He just finished it now, 50 concerts in the United States. Mm-hmm. And in each concert he said something about us. He's really so devoted and so it's unbelievable. But he had also problems. He had problems. And he had some venues were closed for him in the United States. So it's a struggle. But there are some good signs, no doubt. I mean, the young generation of the students, I think, in the United States, there's a bigger and bigger part of the American students who start to understand that something is wrong and that they are part of it and the United States is part of it. It's just very, very slow, but it's going to the right direction. This is a source of hope.
What kind of harassment do you get for speaking so openly?
It depends on the atmosphere. Now it's more relaxed, but 2014, when there was the war in Gaza, I had bodyguards, and it was very, very unpleasant. My partner, someone spit at her in the market, someone spit at me, there was some violence. It can be very unpleasant. Right now it's okay. Right now it's quite calm, because when there is no bloodshed, things are more peaceful.
Does the government try to restrict your travel?
No, nothing. Except of not letting me go to Gaza, but no Israeli is allowed to Gaza. No Israeli. So it's not me. But in the West Bank I go freely, and nothing. I have nothing with the government.
Can you speak a little, just, I know we're short on time, but just a little bit about the state of things in Gaza?
I don't go there, but my partner, she's Swedish, she was there just 2-3 weeks ago. I mean, before she left to Sweden, she was there 1 week before she left to Sweden. Haaretz is doing now something really remarkable. Every day, we give a table of how many hours in each town in the Gaza Strip they have electricity, and what time, because it's not only how many hours, but what time, you know, they have electricity between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
for example. So the whole house is doing all the laundry and everything between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning. The situation is on one hand, you know, there is a report by the UN that by the year 2020, Gaza will, I mean, it will be impossible to live in Gaza. And we are 2017, by the end of 2017, and nobody seems to care a lot. Again, Gaza, as long as Gaza is not launching rockets, nobody cares about Gaza. We taught Gaza that the only way to remind its existence is by violence. Because if they don't do anything, nobody cares about it. And when they do something, so Israel is destroying half of the Gaza Strip, and then there is some kind of interest, and after a few weeks, Gaza is forgotten. It's the biggest cage on earth. It's the biggest prison on earth. It's the biggest experiment in human beings. It's unbelievable that this goes on. We have to mention that Egypt is collaborating with this, because the siege is also by Egypt. Let's remember this, which makes our struggle much harder, because people tell you, what do you want? Egypt is taking part in this siege. So what do you want from Israel? Let Egypt, they are Arabs, they are in the same side. At least let Egypt do something. Egypt is behaving really in a shameful way, shameful way. And the victims, as usual, are 2.5 million people. The nicest 2.5 million people, really. I mean, I love this place, Gaza. Those who know the West Bank and know the Palestinians, who most of them are really warm and nice. You met Palestinians. Such nice. When it gets to Gaza, it is, you have to duplicate it, yeah? They are warmer, they are more courageous, if you can generalize. Yeah, I mean, it's not politically correct to generalize, but Gaza is really a place that always touched my heart. People that I met in Gaza were unforgettable, both their courage, their devotion, and their warmth, really warm people. Living by the sea, unlike the West Bank, which will live more in the mountains or in the hills, makes people more open. When you live by the sea, yeah, you are more open. And now, in the last 10 years, I have no idea what's going on there. And on the other hand, what I wanted to say is that you see also, you see malls, you see hotels. I mean, not very clear how. I don't understand what's going on there, because there are malls, and there are some hotels, and there are some rich people in there. But the majority are living. I mean, it's unbelievable. And look how indifferent is the world about this. And when they come, all those Donald Trumps and others, nobody of them, now the General Secretary of the UN went to Gaza, but all of them don't even bother to go to see it. And the General Secretary of the UN said what he saw there is one of the biggest catastrophes he saw in his life, and he was there only a few hours.
You have been listening to a conversation with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, speaking with a Tree of Life Foundation delegation from the United States, visiting Palestine, Israel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time and hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.